So welcome to day three of the meditation retreat. And this talk is for those of you who haven't gone into jhanas yet. This is all of you. Well, maybe. It's all about the problems in meditation. Why is it that it's so easy to understand? At least I hope it is, because I really put a lot of effort into trying and explaining these things. The path of meditation, the results of meditation, as fully as possible, giving many similes, many from one's own experience, to show exactly what's happening and get metaphors so you can understand exactly what the problem is and how it's solved. But nevertheless, it's not an easy thing to do, to calm the mind down. And obviously the main reason is because it's been our habit for us since we were born, always to control, to try, to strive, and to get where we want to go by forcing it to happen. And unfortunately that's not the way that meditation works. Although many people practice meditation in that way and they don't get anywhere, they just get frustrated and they say, oh, meditation doesn't work. Meditation does work, but you have to follow the instructions. Following the instructions are hard. But little by little you come on a retreat like this, and some of you have been coming a long time, and little by little you do get brainwashed. You do get reconditioned to actually to start meditating in a different way. And every now and again you find that meditation works, you get peaceful, you get happy, and then it gives you the insight. The understanding based on your own personal experience is what it means to be quiet and also how to achieve that. So a lot of times, in order to overcome the problems of meditation, that somehow, some way we've got to trick you, brainwashing trick you or whatever, just to so that you can get just one glimpse of freedom so you understand what we're talking about. That's why in the Buddha Suttas they use the word, the taste of freedom, vimutti rasa. Because once you have a taste of freedom, they know, this is what's on offer at the buffet of this meditation retreat. And once you know what's on offer, you've tasted, you know, the freedom of the mind, then number one, you'll never be able to forget it. And number two, you'll always be investigating why that happens. So one of the problems for meditation is just to get that first experience. And once you get that first experience, then much of the rest of meditation becomes very, very clear. There's a spark there which can light the fire. But in the meantime, the biggest problem which people have in their meditation is thinking too much. You sit down there and you say, watch the breath, and after a few minutes you're thinking about all sorts of things. Have you ever noticed there's no end to the things you can think about? The fantasies, the dreams, the plans, the novels you can write, the film scripts which you can invent, or whatever else you do in your life. There's no end to thinking. But why is it that we think too much? And it's just because it's a habit, it's a conditioned response to the problems in life is to think about it. So the first of the problems I'm going to talk about today is thinking too much. And sometimes you notice that thinking just goes completely sort of out of bounds. You go almost crazy sometimes, the way the thoughts keep on going. What's happened there, they've built up a momentum by themselves and it's so difficult to stop them. You have what's called a crazy mind. It's a mind which has all the hindrances and all the defilements all at once and in force. And usually, sometimes on a retreat, everybody gets the maximum attack of the complete hindrances. They all gang up on you. And to understand just how to deal with it when you think you're really going crazy in meditation, is one of the similes which came from the very early years of experience in Thailand. Again, talking in similes makes these instructions come to life. You can visualize them and you can also understand the wisdom behind the strategies to solve those problems. It happened one day just outside our monastery in Thailand. A man was taking his water buffalo out to the fields to graze. And just as it was passing by our forest monastery, for one reason or another, the water buffalo took fright. He panicked and started to run off. And the man who was leading the water buffalo, the water buffalo had a string tied around its neck like as a lead, and the man was holding on to the other end. Out of stupidity, he tried to hold the water buffalo back. And you should know how big a water buffalo is, how strong they are. That's why they have them, because they can pull a plow where people cut. And so the water buffalo tried to run off. He tried to restrain it. And of course, the water buffalo won. Unfortunately, as the water buffalo was running off, the string wrapped around the top of the man's finger and pulled the top of his finger off. And because it happened right outside our monastery, sort of he came into the monastery straight afterwards, obviously in pain, with half his finger missing. And it looked really, really gross, you know, when sort of a bit of bone and a lot of blood and sort of top of the finger's missing. But, you know, these are tough guys, so he took him to the hospital straight away and sort of got him patched up. But it was great. He's actually was quite okay afterwards. You know, afterwards, after the wound healed, he just had one finger short than the other. Made it more difficult for him to pick his nose. But other than that, he was fine. But it was great for a story. Because that sometimes, and especially it might happen to you in this retreat, you will get to that stage called the water buffalo mind, where it starts to run off. And what do do normally? You try and hold it back. And it usually pulls fingers off or something worse. In other words, sometimes the mind is so crazy you can't stop it. So don't stop it. Let it go. And you know what happens? These water buffalo, they're part of the family. You know, they sort of grow up with everybody. The kids take them out to the fields. The kids can actually, you know, fall asleep on top of them. And the water buffalo won't let the kids fall off. It's part of the family. But sometimes they go a bit crazy. Just like your mind is part of the family. It's part of you. But sometimes it goes a bit crazy. But the point was, if that farmer just let the water buffalo run off, it would have gone off 200, 300, maybe 500 meters at most up the road and then stopped. And then the farmer could very quietly walk after that water buffalo, take hold of the rope and lead it back again. The water buffalo doesn't go far. In the same way that if your mind ever goes crazy, just let it go. Say, okay, mind, you can run off. And after a while, your mind will settle down. And then you can put it back again. And I use that simile, whether it's with crazy kids, crazy husbands, ballistic wives, whatever else it is. If they get that crazy, just let them run off. And when they calm down, then you can actually pull them back again. And that's a great way. So you don't fight battles which you can't win when you lose your fingers. And so that's one of the things with mine. When it goes really crazy, just let it go. Oh, you can do whatever you want. Because the more you try and restrain it, the more you try and pull it in, the more damage it's going to do. It's going to escape. It's going to do that. So let it go. But the point is that we think so much. And the reason why we're thinking so much, again, is because we've got something to do. There's business going on. And again, we're on retreat here. We're supposed to be leaving aside all of our business. I don't know what job you do in the world. But you're not doing it now. This is your vacation time. This is your holiday time. Even if you're unemployed and out of work, you're having a vacation from being unemployed. So you're out of that now. You're in this retreat. So the point is, whatever you do outside, you don't bring it in here. It's not your business. It takes a while for you to realize that. That you don't have to think and plan. And everything goes fine. I call this these days responsible irresponsibility. You don't plan what's going to happen next. You don't figure it all out. You don't have contingency plans for every eventuality. If you do, you'll always find The eventuality which you did not anticipate is the one which occurs, and all your plans mean nothing whatsoever. So if you have responsible irresponsibility, it means you just let things just develop as they are. You should know the best way of looking after the future is to take care of the present. So when that gets into your head, the best way of looking after the future for a successful, prosperous future is having a peaceful present. Look after, care for this present. If you do that, all this idea, I've got a plan, what am I going to do today? How long am I going to sit? Today I'm going to sort of sit for an extra hour in the morning, maybe take a rest after lunch, and then I'll have a cup of tea. You may have your schedule all planned out for today, and it all goes wrong. Perhaps if I had enough nerve, I'd cancel the lunch today, just to show you, you can't anticipate anything. Maybe we won't have any lunch today, who knows? That will just show you, you have to live in the moment, you don't know what's going to happen next. Because sometimes that might happen, you don't know the future. So that's why there's all this thinking and planning. You find whatever you think it's going to be, it's always different. And so you have to use insight to contemplate, and afterwards, all this thinking, what's it ever done for you? Where's it ever got you? So the first thing to do is to undermine the value of your thought. So investigate it and realize it has hardly any value at all. It's like fool's gold. On the surface, if you're not wise, it looks like it's going to get you somewhere. But in the end, it never gets you anywhere. I loved Western philosophy, because Western philosophy really tried to use thinking to get to some truth, until one smart aleck, a great philosopher, finally discovered that you can't prove anything. So 2,000 years of Western philosophy was always a complete waste of time. I realized that years ago. And there's this famous saying which I read a few weeks ago, and I mentioned this at Nolan Mara. It's a great saying. It's a bit crude, so please excuse me, but this actually is one of the fewer known sayings of Karl Marx, who said, philosophy is to real life like masturbation is to sex. It's a great line, that. It's just all this philosophizing, this thinking. It's not real. It's removed from reality. And this is, again, everything which the Buddha said. What you think about is not what's really happening. Even if you give it a name and you note it, you're not actually seeing what's really there. You're just seeing the label. And too many people just see the labels. They believe in those labels. They think the label is the reality. And they just live in a world of labels. And because of that we get into huge amounts of problems and troubles. So, thinking is just labelling. And labelling is not being truthful. The experience is always much deeper than the labels. And the old story is about the man who went into the restaurant. He didn't know the difference between thinking and reality, labels and truth. So he went into the expensive restaurant, the 5-star restaurant, and the maitre d' handed him the menu embossed in gold. And he ate the menu, paid and left. And he was as hungry as when he first went in, and also short of quite a few dollars. And that's a very stupid guy. Instead of doing that, the lady goes into the restaurant, she reads the menu, and that shows her what the food is, she orders the food. And you always know that the food tastes much different than the labels which used to describe it. You understand the difference between the thinking, which is the menu of life, and the reality? So that should get you to take off some of the value of thought. So you don't regard them as important anymore. And that will give you an enormous boost in the way that you meditate. You realize that experience is far different than the thoughts and the labels. And the experience is much more valuable. And it's the thoughts which are deceiving. They're the con men, the dodgy brothers company trying to sell you a used car. That's what thought does. and it's very, very fraudulent and deceptive. All the things which I've thought of in my life, it's never come about. It's always been different than what I expected. That's called fraud. So instead of thinking about things, one experiences. And when you start to experience things and you value the raw experience, you value just the silence, it's through valuing these important stages of meditation that they remain. The reason why people wander off is because they don't value the silence and the peace. Instead, they value thinking. They think it's more important, more fun, it's going to get you somewhere. That's why many people philosophize about religion. And I've often noticed it's the scholars which cause all the problems. In the fundamentalist religions, it's the books which are the cause for the bullets. Those who really practice, who experience, who feel, will never actually shoot bullets or blow themselves up. So that happens also in Buddhism as well. There's too many Buddhist monks these days who put their nose in their books instead of their bum on the cushion. And that's the reason why. Sort of, you know, even Buddhist monks sometimes are not very inspiring. So, when you actually relax, let go, and just watch, then you start to see the thinking mind, you cannot say it's going to stop straight away. It will take time. And of course, one of the reasons, the other obstacle, it's not just thinking too much, understanding you have to somehow transcend this thinking and this complaining mind. The other thing is that we are not patient enough to allow the thinking process to slow down and stop. Because remember that you've been thinking for so many years and you can't just flick a switch and say, right, now I'm going to stop and become quiet. You can't just think, right, 9-day retreat now, I'm going to let go of the world, stop everything, and I'm just going to get into jhana straight away. No one can do that. It takes time. You can imagine one of these big road trains that they have here in Western Australia. Three trailers, maybe four trailers long, rolling down the highway at 110 kilometers an hour, sometimes even faster than that, there's no speed cameras around. Can they stop quickly? They just put on the brakes and then think they're going to just stop in just 1 or 2 meters. It takes sometimes a kilometer for them to stop. Because of their momentum is so strong. And so the momentum you built up in your life with thinking and planning and worrying and dwelling on the past with thoughts, all of that has built up so much momentum it takes time to stop. So you have to be patient. Patience is the fastest way. Which is why during this retreat so far, and for the next few days, I'll also be encouraging you just to allow the process to happen. The more you get in the way and try and make it happen, the more you mess up and stuff up. Your job is just to be the passenger on the journey. Yesterday I gave that simile of giving yourself instructions at the beginning of the meditation, or each stage of the meditation, which is very helpful, because it's like a halfway house between thinking and giving yourself instructions and doing nothing at all. If a person had enough confidence and faith and did absolutely nothing, you'd soon get into deep meditation, but a lot of people just can't do that. Sometimes that when they do nothing, they think everything's going all over the place because they're thinking again. So instead of doing that, I love this little patient halfway house. Okay, you can give yourself a little few instructions, but the beginning of each stage, and then shut up and allow the instructions to work. And in order to make it very plain, I usually give the instruction of the backseat driver. Last year when I went to UK, it was about this time, I was picked up at the airport in Heathrow by a Sri Lankan family, and their son was driving the car with me in the passenger seat, and his mother was in the back. And they were driving from Heathrow to their home in Kent. Now, of course, that boy driving the car, that's where he lived. He was maybe in his mid-20s. He knew how to get there, but for that, the whole journey, his mother was saying, don't go this way, go that way. It's faster. Don't be in the left lane. Go in the right lane. Don't drive too fast. Don't do this and don't do that. And it was a classic case of the backseat driver. And if I wasn't there to calm down this guy sitting next to me, he would have probably started shouting awful obscenities at his mother, simply because his mother was over the top with giving instructions all the time. And I recognize that mother in your mind, always giving yourself instructions when the mind is trying to drive the car. It knows the way from Heathrow to the Jarnes or wherever else you're going. But why is it you always keep butting in and giving instructions? Don't do it this way, do it that way. Come on, Ajahn Brahm said to let go this way. No, no, so another monk said do it this way. And your poor driver gets so confused. Usually he chucks you out. I'm not cooperating anymore. And the mind goes crazy. It goes to sleep or it starts seeking fantasies or whatever else, but it will not cooperate. No wonder it won't. You've given it a hard time. So don't be that backseat driver. All you need to do is give simple instructions. But those instructions have to be precise and clear. Because sometimes this is what happens in monastery. That I am the abbot, so I tell the monks what to do. But sometimes I don't give the instructions clear enough. And so they don't know what's supposed to do, or they do it the wrong way. And I say, go meet me at the hall. Which hall? Or what time? Or when? Or whatever. The problem is that you have to give clear instructions in the same way that you're giving clear instructions to any worker so that they know exactly what needs to be done. And they'll always do it then. You have to do it with kindness. With my monks, I always say, you know, Venerable Anirudh, if it's not too much trouble for you, if you know, if you don't really mind, I'd be very happy if you do this for me. Maybe I don't go that far over the top, but if you did, then people think, oh yeah, we'd like to do this for you, you're just so kind. But you say, if you don't do this, you'll be in big trouble. Then of course, if you use fear, then people usually rebel against that. So with the instructions you give them, I give it clear instructions, kind instructions, gentle instructions, and not over much. That way you can still have a few thoughts, but they're focused on the task, they're very, very clear, and there's not many of them. So that way you are not becoming so restless. And those instructions are very powerful. The reason that we think a lot is because it's a bad habit, that's all. And this programming mindfulness, or sometimes reprogramming it, is an effective way to change habits. You give yourself a clear instruction. I usually repeat it 3 times. Listen intently to what you're saying, and then leave it alone. For those of you who want to experiment, tonight when you go to sleep, this was taught to me in my first meditation retreat in that boarding house in Cambridge. The teacher said, don't set your alarm clocks. Instead, when you lay down in bed, make a resolution. I would get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. I would get up at 4 o'clock. I would get up at 4 o'clock. And of course, I didn't believe it, but I thought I was willing to give anything a try. And I really couldn't. It was amazing. 1 or 2 minutes either side of 4 a.m., I got up. I just woke up, looked at the clock, and there it was. 1 or 2 minutes either side of 4. It's amazing just how your mind will respond to instructions if it's given clearly and you pay attention while you're giving them to yourself. And that's the way to drive the meditation in the correct direction without thinking too much, without being too restless, but still giving yourself a direction. Giving yourself those clear instructions at the beginning. I will be in the present moment. I will avoid the past and future. I'll be in the present moment. I'll avoid the past and future. I'll be in the present moment. I'll avoid the past and future. Then shut up. And then you'll be amazed. Give yourself time. Be patient. And the mind will start to dwell in the present moment. It will do that because you've given it instructions and it will do the work for you. You have to trust that mind. And it's a great way of dealing with the difficulties and problems of life without filling your mind up with so many worries. Even these days I've got so many responsibilities to do, but sometimes that's all I do. I just tell myself I must ring up, say, the president, Seoul, at 3 p.m. this afternoon. I'm mushrooming up at 3 p.m. I'm mushrooming up at 3 p.m. Then I forget about it. It's incredible. Just when you trust your mind like that, a few minutes before 3, the thought comes into your mind, I'm mushrooming up so. I trust that now. So it's a great way of having a warning system or an alert system, a note system, which you don't have to keep in your bag. You can just remember, simply because you tell yourself to. So what you're doing there is limiting the amount of time you need to think. And you can have more space instead, which means the mind gets less restless. Nevertheless, if you haven't got any business, sometimes we take other people's business on board. For example, that somebody might be talking, and you think that's against the rules. Ajahn Brahm said we should have noble silence, and you go thinking about that all night. Or you see somebody sneak into the kitchen at 4:05 to go and get themselves something to eat. Anything sneaks, cheats, they're not keeping those precepts. And that sort of makes you upset. The point is, it's none of your business what other people do. So when you use the word, none of my business, it makes you more free. You don't have to think about so much. And I've taken that none of your business to an extreme, because it's not just what you do, it's what I do is none of my business either. If I think a lot, it's none of my business. It's all anatta, not me, not mine, not a self. So I say none of my business. If I fall asleep, none of my business. If I get into jhana, none of my business. That's another way of saying not me, not mine, not a self. That's the no self reflection. Instead of saying it's not a soul and then getting into another philosophical line of thought about what is a soul anyway, what does the self mean, what is the self, it's to say it's none of my business. Isn't that a great thing? Whatever comes into your mind, none of my business. Another thought comes into the mind, none of my business. The sound of the cars, none of my business. The smell of the food, none of my business. An ache in the leg, none of my business. A thought in the mind, none of my business. It's called detaching. When it's none of your business, you've got nothing to worry about. Isn't that wonderful? You've got no business at all. Well, another person does, at last I don't need to worry about them. I'm not the policeman anymore. Whatever happens in this retreat center, we don't own it. It belongs to the Catholics. It's their problem. Whatever happens towards the day, the weather, raining or not raining, it's not our problem, it's the meteorological office's problem. Nothing to do with us. Whatever anyone else does, if they let off wind, if they burp, if they fall asleep, not my problem. And even if you let off wind, it's not my problem, you've let it go. Someone else's problem now, the one sitting behind you. But the point is, even thoughts which come up your mind, not my problem. Now, if you keep doing that consistently with everything, even the beautiful states, the not so beautiful states, not none of my problem. You know, the which is right, vipassana or samatha, none of my problem. You know, which is the right religion, none of my problem. Which is the best meditator, the best teacher, none of my problem. When it's none of your problem, you're free. You've nothing to do. So the restlessness disappears with not my problem mantra. You can even say that to yourself. Breathing in, not my. Breathing out, problem. Not my problem. What that actually does to you, it stops you creating business. And our difficulty is, we are business men and business women. We're business yogis. We're business monks. By that I mean, we don't start a company to try and make money. We're all busy bodies, which is why we're thinking, always doing something. And sometimes we're not doing work, if we're not doing a chores, we're doing meditation. We're doing it instead of getting out of the way and resting and being still. So the biggest problem there is doing too much. And in fact, you can call the whole path of meditation is understanding this dukkha and calming it down, stilling it. Because the opposite of doing is stillness. That way, you understand there is no difficulty in meditation. The problems in meditation, they're not yours. When they're not yours, and you really practice this properly, it works. In other words, the mind gets very still, because there's nothing to do. There's nothing to solve. There's nothing to fix up for the future. All you do is just watch this present moment. It's here now. You can't change it. Now it's here. So what are you going to do about this present moment? All you do is watch it. Be observing it. Don't even try and figure it out. Just observe passively. And then you get very, very still. A simile, which is one I always use, but in a different context during the retreat, is what happens when you are still, when you don't move around, when you're not restless. It's the nature of the mind when you are still that you tend to focus. The mind bores into it. And the simile which I use is the simile of the teacher, meditation instructor, who was teaching his disciples how to meditate using archery. And the man went to his three students and decided it was time of the year to give them an exam, give them a test. So he took them to the forest with a bow and three arrows. And he pointed to a tree in the far distance. And he said, "Can you see on that tree, on a branch, there is a bird on that tree? But don't worry, it's not a real bird. We are vegetarians. That is a doll of a bird. Now that is your target." And he said, "It's impossible to hit that bird from this distance." He said, "It is if you don't know how to focus. But the task is much more than just hitting that bird with the arrow. You've got to shoot that arrow through the left eyeball of that stuffed bird. Not through the right eyeball, not through the head, the body, just through the left eyeball. And the only way you can achieve such a magnificent feat of archery is to make yourself one with the target." "Okay," he said, giving the bow and arrow to the first student. "Focus on the target. Make yourself one with the target. Meditate, and before you shoot, give me a sign." So the student focused, meditated, made himself one with the target. It took him 30 minutes, and he gave the teacher a sign. Teacher said, "Wait. Can you see the bird on the tree?" "Yes, master," he said, without taking his gaze away from the target. "Stupid student," said the master, grabbed the bow and arrow and said, "Go and learn some meditation." And he gave the bow and arrow to the second student. Same instructions. Make yourself one with the target. You've got to shoot that arrow to the left eyeball of the bird. But focus, first of all. When you're one with the target, give me a sign. After 1 hour of focusing, the student gave the sign. Master said, "Can you see the bird on the tree?" Student said, "What tree?" "Ooh," said the master. "Can you see the bird?" "Oh yes." "Stupid student, grab the bow and arrow. Go and learn some meditation with that other dummy who went first." And then he gave the bow and arrow to the last student. "Make yourself one with the target. When you're ready, give me a sign." After 2 hours of focusing, 2 hours of sweat, 2 hours of solid stillness, he gave a sign. Master said, "Can you see the bird on the tree?" "What tree?" said the student. "Hmm," said the master.
Can you see the bird? What bird? Said the student. Wow, said the master, what can you see?
All I can see is one eyeball.
Cool, said the master.
Shoot.
And of course the arrow went through the only thing left in the student's field of attention, the left eyeball. This is what happens when you focus. When you are still on something and you don't move, you tend to focus inwards, into the center of things. It's what you do when you watch the TV, when you go to the movies, even though there's a big movie screen, at least the last time I went there was, big movie screen. If you focus, after a little while you cannot see the edges of that screen. Even if it's a small, I've seen these days people have got their mobile phones and they can have a TV screen on it. Even when they're watching that mobile, you can actually focus in, you can't even see the edges of your mobile phone. You can't even see the edges of the screen and the buttons underneath. You just focus in on the image. Try that the next time you have one of those high-tech new mobiles. And I say, it's very helpful because once you know how the mind looks at screens, especially TV screens, you know that psychologically the truth of the matter inside your mind is that if you look at a 6 foot wide, 3 foot high LCD TV screen, it looks, appears exactly the same in your mind as if you have one of these mini TVs. The experience is no different when you're focusing. The movie, the soccer, the news will look exactly the same. Because you won't notice the edges of the screen and the center just fills the whole mind to its edges. So that way, you can sell your $3,000 or $4,000 LCD screen, buy a small TV, and you can give the rest to the Buddhist Society of Western Australia. That way you can save a lot of money and you can make a lot of merit at the same time. You still have the same experience when you watch your TVs. Now those of you who have faith. But anyhow, the point is, that's what happens in this meditation of focusing. You don't need to think, you don't need to move the process along. It's a natural process. One of the biggest obstacles in meditation is once you begin the process, you don't give it time to work. You interfere. You want to move it along faster. You want something to happen. You want to go on to the next stage. Again, it's just all of our habitual tendencies of our life. We go to a new classroom to go to grade 2 after we've finished grade 1. We go sometimes to a new school after we finish grade 7. We go to a new institution when we finish grade 12. We're always going somewhere else. But the point is, in meditation, we go in to this moment, into the silence, into the breath, into the beautiful breath, in to the nimitta, in to the jhanas. You don't go on somewhere else. There's concentric rooms of a house. Now, when you understand that, you understand that one of the other big problems in meditation is expectation. Expectation is when you're looking for another room, somewhere else. You think that jhana is in the next moment, in the next stage, in the next thing. Expectation is the opposite of what? Of inspectation. You're supposed to look inwards. Even the word expect, it means you're actually looking outside of where you are, outside of this experience, outside of this moment. You've gone into the future. You've lost the present moment awareness. Now that present moment awareness is so important that sometimes when I'm getting into a deep state of meditation, even like beautiful breath or even nimittas, when I get into like a nimitta stage, sometimes there's a block there And the reason is because you've gone so far in the meditation, you've actually lost some of the focus of present moment awareness. It's very much like you're looking through a camera or a telescope or binoculars, and it's just slightly out of focus, so it's the image is smeared. This is like a smear over time. It's just lingering a tiny bit in the past, smearing off into the future. You're not precise in the moment. And I've used that very, very powerfully. As soon as I, watching an imitant, present moment awareness, come on. I focus. I don't say those words, it's just non-verbal. And as soon as you focus that way, the image gets sharp. And then you're off into deep meditation. So that present moment awareness is just the sharpening of the present moment. So you're right in the moment, precisely in the now. There's not even a fraction of a second of the from the behind you or in front of you left in your mind. It's powerful. Because what happens then, you can't expect anything. Because expectation is in the next millisecond. You can't expect anything, you can't want anything. You're just right there. So present moment awareness is very, very, very powerful to stop some of the biggest problems in meditation. The same as not looking at the past. Any of you who judge your meditation, it's good meditation, bad meditation, I'm not getting anywhere, this is not working. You're just off in the past again. You're looking at the meditation so far, assessing it, you've lost the present moment. This present moment, you cannot judge. The only way you can judge is compare this with something else. In the present moment, there's nothing left to compare with. You can't judge. So a huge number of problems in meditation disappear if you really focus on the present moment. And remember that throughout the meditation, if you're watching the breath, breath happening in this tiny fraction of a second now means you can't want anything, nor can you sort of judge anything. Which comes to the last obstacle of meditation, which surprisingly is one of the biggest for people on this retreat, is ill will. Fault finding, negativity. It's a strange thing to realize that the biggest hindrance of all is not actually desire or wanting or even thinking. It's actually underlying thinking. It's ill will, not being happy, not being content, being fault finding. Because in our life, fault finding has been taken to such an extreme in our modern world, you pick up a newspaper and you find fault with everybody. You listen to a talk, and all the wonderful pieces of information you forget about, you find fault with them. You've got a wonderful husband, there's a few things wrong he does, and that's all you remember. We're such fault finders in our world that we are living in a culture of negativity, of little appreciation, which means we can't live with other people, divorce rates going high, we're never satisfied with the houses we live in. We're always just so busy because we just look in our house and see all the things which need to be done, need to be fixed up. It's an endless task. And now we come on this retreat, we look at ourselves and see all the things which need to be fixed up with ourselves. Or need all the things which need to be fixed up with the person sitting next to you. Or with the place. I mean, it's amazing just how many faults we can notice. In that fault-finding mind, now you look at your meditation, it's not good enough. I'm only on the first stage, and I've been meditating for 30 years, and I'm about to die. This is not good enough. That fault-finding mind is enemy number one. You know, the FBI have this list of enemy number one, most wanted person. That's the most wanted hindrance, fault-finding. You test that one out. You find fault with the meditation. Ah, these instructions aren't really good. Or, not as good as the last retreat Ajahn Brahm gave. Whatever, you know, what that was. Because, you know, you can't really remember. I don't remember what I did. Don't know how you can. Amazing what memory you've got. But the point is, when we're fault finding, we're a negative mind, we always find fault with everything. But the worst thing is, we find fault with the present moment. This is not good enough. I want something more. Which means you never stay still. The standard simile for that is the mangy dog. Ajahn Chah used to use that simile so often, but it actually comes from the suttas. Once there was a dog with mange, and it itched so much. And it couldn't get rid of that itch. It was living in the village, and so it thought, maybe if I go in the forest, I can escape from the itch. So it ran into the forest under the shade of a tree, and still it really itched. So I thought, that didn't work. Maybe I should stand out in the fields, and it might go away. So it stood out in the fields, and still it itched. Maybe I can dive into the river. It dived into the river, and it still itched. Maybe I can go in the cave, and it still itched. Wherever it went, it itched, because the itch was on it. It's in the body. And this is the trouble with people with the mangy mind. The mangy mind is the fault-finding virus, which means wherever you go, you may go home. You think, I've had enough of this retreat. And you go home and still you're not happy. Or you may say, okay, let's go to a movie. So you go to your favourite movie. I don't know what movie's on right now. And you're still, itchy and mangy. Or you say, maybe Buddhism's not right. Become a Christian and go next door. And still you carry the itch with you. It's a fault-finding mind. It's a mange. Say, okay, I'm going to meditate and then I'll be okay. And you still take that itch with you into your meditation. It's not good enough. It's amazing that some people have actually got nimittas already. And they're still not happy. Gee, come on. They think, no, I need jhana. So they get first jhana. Oh, I need second jhana. You can see what happens. Actually, you never get to that sort of jhana with such a fault-finding mind. So instead of having a fault-finding mind, which is ill will, you're not actually appreciating things. We balance that with some nice loving kindness. You can see that throughout the instructions so far, I've always sourced every talk with like kindness, gentleness. And that's actually, it's not I don't teach like this just to be popular or just to suck up to people or make people feel good. Because this, I know this is the way it works. This is how I meditate. I went through that tough guy meditation, trying to out-meditate other people. See who's going to sit the longest. Remember some early retreats, I would sit here at night time, determined I'd be the last person who goes to bed. So 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, I'd open my eyes, two or three people left. Damn it. Close my eyes and sit for another quarter of an hour. Another quarter of an hour. Still one person left. Yeah, I'm going to beat them. That's a stupid thing to do. But sometimes that's what happens with people. There's so much tough guy or tough girl image. And that's not the way we meditate. Keep it nice and soft. And with the softness, you eradicate the fault-finding mind. This moment is good enough. In fact, it's beautiful. When you've changed a fault-finding mind to the perception of beauty, in this moment, with this stupid, crazy, restless mind, it's good enough for me. The very fact that I've come here on this retreat, that's enough good karma and merit. The very fact that maybe you might have an opportunity to put some food in the monks and the sisters' bowl. Oh, that's a wonderful thing to be able to do. That you're keeping precepts, you're being harmless, you're being peaceful. What a great thing you're doing this weekend. If that's all you achieve, that's enough. When you're actually like that, you're not demanding. You're just so grateful just for a moment just to be sit on a cushion. The very fact you're sitting there with your eyes closed, that's enough. Anything else is just gravy. When you don't ask for anything, when you're so grateful, there's no ill will at all, there's no fault finding, your meditation just takes off into the stratosphere. You don't find fault with yourself? Stupid me. How long have I been coming here? I'm a Buddhist for years. and I still haven't got into deep meditation. Don't think like that. If you think like that, you'll never get anywhere. Instead, let go of all the past. Be kind to the present moment. Embrace it. Let it be with a smile, not with picking faults at it. And if you stop that fault-finding mind, there's nothing to think about. There's nothing to really get. This is good enough. What happens is you have no business anymore. Business starts with finding fault. When you're seeing a fault, now you've got something to do. When you get something to do, then you become restless. You've got thoughts, plans, things to do in the world. And that causes all of the problems in meditation. Instead, if you stop the fault-finding mind, get an appreciative mind, a mind of loving kindness, the door of my heart is open to this moment, no matter what it is, the unconditional mindfulness, this beautiful looking at this, whatever it is, and embracing it fully. It's all caused by past karma, here it is. You can't change it now. All you can do is make nice karma in the present moment. By being kind. By being gentle. By being accepting. And that way, the fault-finding mind stops. In its place gets stillness and joy. And it builds and builds and builds and builds. Until you get so still, you get so much fun and happiness. You look, it's quite true. There's no fault in things, it's just life. This is what life does. What do you expect of mosquitoes? So they bite. That's what they're programmed to do. What do you expect when we get beans for breakfast? That people are going to fart. It's not their fault, it's just body. That's all it is. What do you expect? You know, sometimes people are going to snore when they go to sleep. What do you expect that you're sometimes that you're not going to be so bright when you meditate in the morning? Sometimes you're going to be on top form. It's just change. It's nature. It's life. So when you appreciate these things, instead of trying to control them, when you don't find fault, but you find beauty in things, you can just sit down with a tired, aching body and see it as beautiful. You don't find fault with this. It's just my body getting old, that's all. And you can be still with it. There's nothing to do. When there's nothing to do, the doing stops. And you start focusing. It's in the stillness the mind starts to go in. What's on the edge, on the periphery, disappears. And what was once in the middle is now the periphery. You focus in and in and in. And I'm just going to mention that just one more time about that focusing. Because sometimes that people are, say, watching their breath, and there's the sounds of things outside, people coming up, or yesterday the aircraft, or it can be the gardener outside with his lawnmower. It can be feelings in the body. So what should I do with those feelings in the body, those disturbances? Always keep them on the edge of your screen, never center on them. So you can be watching your breath, and those sounds or those feelings in the body are on the edge of the screen, never in the center. If you make them a problem, if they're important, they take the center of the screen of your mind. And then the breath falls off the edge. You lost the breath. But if you always keep your meditation object in the center of your screen, sure you can hear those sounds, but they're on the edge, they're over there somewhere. Sure you can feel the body, but it's over there somewhere. Center is on the breath. And just like watching the TV screen, after a little while, what's on the top, bottom, on the sides, disappears from your view. So those feelings in the body, those sounds outside, just falls off the screen of your mind. So all you've got left is the breath. Next time you watch the TV, check that one out. So when you're in the middle of the movie, or the cricket match or whatever, you will notice for a second that you can't see the edges of the screen. The whole vision finishes just on the image of the cricket pitch. You don't notice that it's enclosed in a box called your TV, which gives you the illusion you're just right there. So the same way that if you keep the image of, say, the breath in the center of your screen, keep focusing it on there. Other stuff can come in. You're not trying to get rid of things. It's allowed in. But as long as you're centering on the breath, after a while everything else fades away. It falls off, and all you've got left is the breath. Beautiful breath. Everything else eventually falls off. A nimitta, keep that in the center of the screen. Soon afterwards everything else disappears. Your whole body is gone. You don't know where it's gone. Disappeared. Sounds gone. This is actually how we meditate. By focusing in the center. By not fault finding. Finding fault is bringing the problems to the center of the screen. Making them important. Giving them priority. Making that the business. And as soon as you've got business to do, you've blown it. You never solve the business that way. There's just too much to do. Instead, you allow it to drop off the screen. That's the problem of restlessness. Thinking too much. Started off by talking about thinking. The reason why you think too much is you value it. You've been conditioned that way. So the way to overcome it is to take away its value. Value of meditation much more. Also, not to be so fault-finding. Using a bit of non-self, it's none of my business, nothing to do, and do focusing. And that way, what was a problem before just disappears. The ill will, overcome by a little bit of loving kindness. So you're delighting in the moment, this is good enough for me. And with that gentleness, with that kindness, the meditation just develops just so easily, so beautifully. You understand what the problems were all along. Not expecting anything, not wanting anything, because you stay in the present moment. What you have here, you delight in, whatever it is, this is good enough. You focus, and everything happens. So, that's the talk this evening on some of the problems of meditation, especially no fault finding. So, has anyone got any complaints about the talk this morning? Any faults? Well, we never said this. Any comments about the talk? Yeah.
Just a comment. whatever your talk this morning,
yeah.
Just confirm what I mean have just gone through.
Very good.
Letting go and things started to happen.
There we go. What a wonderful thing you just said. It's amazing. You see, that's not fault finding. It's good, it works. And as I said at the very beginning, this is the most important thing, that I keep giving these instructions. It goes against the grain because you haven't heard these things before. It goes against the way of the world, but eventually, now and again, you'll try these things, you'll do it because I've been conditioning and brainwashing you so much. And when you do it, you do find it actually works. That's why we talk like this. And when it does work, yes, this is it. And there's nothing more beautiful in life than the peace of the mind. So if that's all you get in this retreat, you'll be one very happy person, and I'll be a very happy teacher. So I've given you the greatest of gifts, the understanding of what peace of mind is. Okay, so now we have the interview times, I believe. Okay, yep. And the list is on the board outside. So I've only seen one person cross their name off. So if you can come in order, one by one, and talk about your meditation. And the afternoon list is on there. If I left anybody out by mistake, please let me know, because sometimes I make mistakes and the list is sometimes not accurate who's actually here. Sometimes I spell the names wrong. Whatever it is, please forgive me. Don't find too much fault, but let me know.